A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's not really about financial literacy or investment strategy. It's about the emotional texture of money. He describes a kind of hatred for money that has nothing to do with his bank balance. This deep discomfort watching human beings have to put a numeric value on their time, their labor, their survival. He mentions struggling to command his own rate, being haunted by inequality during the wars in Israel, a landlord who let a leak destroy their apartment, and this dream of a society where nobody has to negotiate for their basic dignity. Then he asks, does what I'm articulating fit into a specific school of thought, and who's advocating for a change that would get us at least part of the way there?
This is one of those prompts where someone has done the hard emotional work of noticing something real, and now they're asking whether the intellectual tradition has a name for it. The answer is yes, several names, actually, and the thread that ties them together is the idea that money is not neutral.
Say more about that. Money is not neutral. Most economists would disagree, right? The textbook view is that money is just a medium of exchange, a veil over real transactions.
That's exactly the view that's been challenged, and the most important challenge came from Karl Polanyi, a Hungarian economic historian who published The Great Transformation in 1944. His core argument was that turning labor, land, and money into commodities, things you buy and sell on markets, is not natural. He called them fictitious commodities. Labor is not produced for sale, land is not produced at all, and money is a token of purchasing power that emerges from the state. Treating them like widgets is what creates the degradation the prompt is describing.
So the feeling of wrongness when a human being has to price their own hours, that's not a personal neurosis. Polanyi would say you're perceiving something real about the structure.
He wrote that allowing the market mechanism to be the sole director of the fate of human beings and their natural environment would result in the demolition of society. Not disruption, not inequality, demolition. And he was writing in the shadow of the 1930s, watching what happened when societies tried to treat labor purely as a commodity. The prompt's intuition that there's something degrading about reducing a person to an hourly rate. Polanyi built an entire theoretical framework around that.
What's the alternative? Because the prompt explicitly says barter isn't viable, and I think we can all agree that's correct. The barter economy is a myth that never existed at scale anyway. What does Polanyi propose?
He's not proposing abolishing markets. He's arguing for embedding markets within social relationships rather than letting markets dominate all social relationships. For most of human history, that's how it worked. Economic activity was woven into kinship, religion, political obligation. The Great Transformation was disembedding the economy, making it a separate sphere with its own logic. The alternative is re-embedding it.
That sounds nice in theory. What does it actually mean in practice?
It means institutions and policies that protect people from being treated as pure market inputs. Social safety nets, labor protections, universal basic services. These aren't just nice to have welfare policies in this framework. They're mechanisms that keep society from being demolished by the market logic applied to things that aren't actually commodities.
The prompt's dream of a society where everyone has a safety net and basic dignity, that's not just sentiment. That's aligned with a major school of economic thought.
And Polanyi is having a moment right now, actually. There's been a resurgence of interest in his work since the 2008 financial crisis, and especially during the pandemic years. Would people see supply chains break and suddenly realize the market doesn't provide everything, Polanyi's warnings feel less abstract.
Let me push on something, though. The prompt describes a feeling of hatred for money itself. Not just for inequality or poverty, for the act of putting a number on a human interaction. That feels more specific than markets need to be embedded. It's almost a moral revulsion.
This is where Viviana Zelizer enters the conversation. She's a sociologist at Princeton who spent decades studying how people actually use money, not how economists model it, but how real humans navigate the moral meaning of payments. Her book, The Social Meaning of Money, is a foundational text here. She documents how people constantly create what she calls relational work, matching different kinds of payments to different kinds of social relationships.
Give me an example of relational work.
The classic one, you don't hand your spouse a $100 bill after dinner. That would be grotesque, not because money is inherently degrading, but because the payment form doesn't match the relationship. But you might give your spouse a gift card to a nice restaurant, which is money but laundered through a social form. Zelizer shows that people do this constantly. We earmark money, we distinguish between clean and dirty money, we feel different about a paycheck versus an inheritance versus money found on the street.
The prompt's discomfort with negotiating a babysitter's rate. That's not a failure to be rational about money. That's relational work failing.
The babysitter occupies this ambiguous social position. She's not family, she's not an employee in the formal sense, she's in your home, she's caring for your children. The relationship is intimate, but the transaction is monetary. That creates what Zelizer calls hostile worlds. Tension, the sense that money and intimacy are contaminating each other. The prompt's hatred of money in that context is the emotional experience of that tension.
That's a useful phrase. It names something I think a lot of people feel but can't articulate, the sense that there are spheres of life money shouldn't touch.
Zelizer's point is that this isn't irrational. The money is neutral. Crowd would say you're just being squeamish. Pay the market rate and move on. But Zelizer's research shows that ignoring the moral dimension of payments actually damages relationships and creates real psychological costs.
We've got Polanyi saying that treating labor as a commodity demolishes society, and Zelizer saying that people naturally resist treating all money as fungible because they're doing relational work. What about the political dimension? The prompt mentions the wars in Israel, seeing poverty, the landlord who wouldn't fix a leak. There's something about power asymmetry here, too.
This is where the conversation shifts from the meaning of money to the structure of who gets to set the terms. The prompt describes struggling to command his own rate. That's not just emotional discomfort, that's a bargaining power problem. And the landlord situation is even starker. The landlord has something the tenant needs to survive, shelter, and can simply refuse to maintain it. The tenant's only recourse is legal, which requires time and money and emotional bandwidth that someone in crisis may not have.
That's the thing about housing specifically. It's not like choosing between brands of toothpaste. You can't opt out of needing shelter. The market doesn't clear. You just suffer.
This connects to an older tradition in economic thought that gets overlooked. The prompt asks if there's a school of thought. There's also the concept of moral economy, which comes from the historian E. He was studying 18th century English food riots, of all things, and he noticed that the rioters weren't just hungry mobs. They had a coherent moral framework. They believed that when grain merchants hoarded food during shortages to drive up prices, they were violating a shared understanding of how the economy should work, that people shouldn't profit from others' starvation.
The rioters weren't anti-market. They were anti-exploitation within the market.
And Thompson argued that this moral economy persists beneath the surface of market society. It erupts when the gap between market logic and moral logic becomes too wide to ignore. I think the prompt is describing a quiet, internal version of that same eruption.
The landlord who lets a leak destroy someone's home. That's a violation of moral economy. It's not illegal, necessarily. Depends on the jurisdiction. But it's wrong in a way that market logic alone can't capture.
When the prompt says, I've had a hard time looking away when I see poverty around me, that's the moral economy asserting itself against the comfortable idea that market outcomes are just outcomes.
Let me bring in something from the research that ties this together. There's a philosopher named Michael Sandel at Harvard. His book, What Money Can't Buy, catalogues the ways market logic has expanded into spheres where it doesn't belong. Paying kids for good grades, buying the right to shoot endangered species, vending machine access to prison cell upgrades. His argument is that markets don't just allocate goods, they express and shape values. When you put a price on something, you change what it means.
Sandel's book is from 2012, but it's aged remarkably well. His core question is, what should money not be able to buy? And he's not arguing from economics, he's arguing from moral philosophy. Some things are degraded when they're bought and sold, even if both parties consent to the transaction.
I think that's the heart of what the prompt is feeling. Not, I wish I had more money or inequality is bad, though both may be true. It's I hate what money does to human relationships when it enters spaces where it doesn't belong.
The babysitter example is perfect for this. The parent doesn't want to underpay. The babysitter doesn't want to overcharge. But the very act of negotiation forces both parties into a market frame that feels wrong for the relationship.
It's the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. The transaction is functional, but it strips the color out of something that should be warmer.
And I think there's a specific dynamic in Israeli society that makes this more acute. The prompt mentions the wars. When you're in a society under constant threat, the gap between market logic and communal solidarity becomes more visible. You see people risking their lives in reserve duty while others are price gouging. The moral economy becomes harder to ignore.
It's interesting. Israel actually has a strong tradition of mutual aid and collective provision. The kibbutz movement, the histadrut, the welfare state infrastructure that was built in the early decades. Some of that has eroded, but the cultural memory is there.
The prompt seems to be reaching toward something like that. The dream of a society where nobody has to negotiate for survival, that's not a new dream. It's the dream behind social democracy, behind certain strands of religious teaching, behind a lot of the utopian experiments of the 19th and 20th centuries.
Let's get concrete. The prompt asks two things. Does this fit into a school of thought? And who's advocating for change that would get us part of the way there? We've covered the first part. Polanyi, Zaliza, Moral Economy, Sandel. What about the second?
There are several currents worth naming. The most direct is the Universal Basic Income movement. The idea is straightforward. Every citizen receives a regular cash payment, no strings attached, enough to cover basic needs. This directly addresses the prompt's concern about people being forced to negotiate for survival. If your survival isn't at stake in the negotiation, the power dynamic changes entirely.
UBI has had an interesting trajectory. It was a fringe idea for decades. Then it got a lot of attention around 2016 to 2020. Then it seemed to fade. Where does it stand now?
The experiments continue. Finland ran a 2-year trial that ended in 2018. The results were mixed on employment, but strongly positive on well-being and mental health. Kenya has been running a 12-year trial organized by GiveDirectly. Stockton, California ran a mayoral pilot. And during the pandemic years, we essentially ran a massive unplanned experiment with stimulus checks and expanded child tax credits. The U.S. child tax credit expansion in 2021 cut child poverty by roughly 30% before it expired.
Then Congress let it expire.
Which is itself an illustration of how political will for this kind of thing fluctuates. The evidence was strong. It worked. But the ideological opposition to unconditional cash was stronger.
The prompt asked for alternatives that would get us at least part of the way there. A BI feels like the maximalist version. What are the incremental approaches?
Universal basic services is one. Instead of giving everyone cash, you guarantee access to specific things: housing, healthcare, education, transportation, internet. The argument is that this is more politically achievable than UBI and addresses the specific dignity problems more directly. Nobody has to negotiate for healthcare if healthcare is just provided.
That's essentially the Nordic model, isn't it?
It is, with variations. And it's worth noting that the Nordic countries consistently top well-being and happiness rankings. Though I'm always skeptical of those rankings, the pattern is persistent enough to take seriously. When people don't have to worry about losing their home or going bankrupt from medical bills, something changes in their relationship with money.
The prompt mentions being more attuned to inequality during the wars. There's something about crisis that makes the existing safety net, or lack of it, suddenly visible. When things are calm, you can tell yourself the system works. When things break, you see who falls through.
That connects to another school of thought worth mentioning, disaster economics, or more precisely, the critique of disaster capitalism. Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, documented how crises are routinely used to push through market-oriented policies that would be rejected in normal times. But the flip side is also true. Crises can reveal the inadequacy of market provision and build support for alternatives.
I want to circle back to something the prompt said that I think we haven't fully addressed. I struggle to command my own rate. That's not just about the emotional texture of money. That's about self-worth and bargaining power. It's a practical problem.
It's gendered, statistically. Women are less likely to negotiate starting salaries, less likely to ask for raises, and when they do negotiate, they face social penalties that men don't. But the prompt isn't asking about gender dynamics specifically. I think this is a broader phenomenon. Some people have a visceral aversion to self-advocacy around money because it feels like asserting that you're worth more than someone else.
Which is exactly what the market requires you to do. The market doesn't care about your discomfort. It just produces a number. If you don't name your number, someone else names it for you, and it'll be lower than what you could have gotten.
There's a book by Sarah Ahmed that I think is relevant here, though she's writing about a different topic. She talks about the feminist killjoy, the person who ruins the mood by pointing out something wrong that everyone else is ignoring. I think there's a version of that around money. The person who says, I need to be paid more, is disrupting the pretense that we're all just here for the love of the work, and that disruption feels aggressive even when it's justified.
The discomfort with commanding your own rate is partly about not wanting to be the killjoy. You'd rather accept less than rupture the social harmony.
Employers know this. It's why they love mission-driven organizations. You can pay people less if they believe in the cause. The mission becomes a subsidy to the employer.
That's a bleak way to put it.
It is, but it's also true. And it's not necessarily exploitative in every case. People genuinely derive meaning from work, and that meaning has value. But the dynamic exists, and the prompt seems to be aware of it without quite naming it.
Let me try to synthesize what we've covered for the listener. The prompt describes a hatred of money that's really about three things. 1. The degradation of reducing human relationships to prices. 2. The power asymmetry that forces some people to accept whatever they're offered because they can't afford to walk away. 3. The moral injury of living in a society where this is normal. The intellectual tradition that names this includes Polanyi on fictitious commodities, Zelizer on relational work and hostile worlds, Thompson on moral economy, and Sandel on the moral limits of markets. The policy responses range from UBI to universal basic services to stronger labor protections and social housing.
That's a good summary. I'd add one more name, Pope Francis. Not because this is a religious podcast, it's not, but because he's been one of the most prominent voices arguing that the current economic order degrades human dignity. His 2015 encyclical Laudato Si explicitly critiques the idea that market logic should govern all human relationships. He calls it the technocratic paradigm and argues it reduces people to objects. Whether or not you're Catholic, the critique resonates with what the prompt is describing.
It's interesting that this critique comes from multiple directions. A Marxist-influenced economic historian, a Princeton sociologist, a Harvard philosopher, and the Pope. They're not all in the same political camp, but they're all pointing at the same thing.
Which suggests the thing is real. When people with very different starting assumptions converge on a similar critique, it's worth paying attention.
The prompt also asks about a middle ground between barter and the current system. I think that's a productive way to frame it, not tear it all down. But what can we build alongside it?
One model that's gaining traction is the idea of a participation income. This was proposed by the British economist Anthony Atkinson in the 1990s. It's like UBI, but with a condition. You have to be contributing to society in some recognized way. But contribution is defined broadly. Care work, volunteering, artistic creation, studying. The idea is to preserve the dignity of reciprocity. You're not just receiving, you're participating, while still guaranteeing that nobody falls through the cracks.
That addresses one of the main objections to UBI, which is the something-for-nothing critique. Though I'd argue that the something-for-nothing critique is itself a product of the market logic that treats human worth as something that must be earned through paid labor.
It absolutely is. And it's historically contingent. The idea that your moral worth depends on your labor market participation is relatively new. In most societies throughout history, people were valued for reasons that had nothing to do with wages.
The prompt mentions being haunted by seeing poverty on the street. I think there's something about visibility here, too. In a society with a strong safety net, poverty becomes less visible. Not because it disappears entirely, but because the most acute forms of it are buffered. When you see people sleeping on the street, that's a policy choice, not an inevitability.
Israel specifically has seen rising inequality and housing costs that have made this more visible. The cost of living protests in 2011 were a major moment, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets over housing and food prices. The underlying issues haven't been fully resolved. When the prompt says a middle-class family is a couple of crises away from losing their home, that's not hyperbole in the current Israeli housing market.
The leak story is specific and awful. A landlord who refuses to fix a leak isn't just being cheap. They're making a calculation that the tenant's suffering is cheaper than the repair. That's market logic applied to human shelter. And the prompt is right to find that morally repulsive.
Strong tenant protections are one of the most direct ways to address this specific problem. In Germany, for example, tenants have much stronger rights. Rent control is widespread, evictions are harder, and landlords have clear legal obligations to maintain habitability. It's not utopia, but it shifts the power balance.
That's a concrete policy, not a philosophical dream. You don't need to restructure the entire economy to pass stronger tenant protections.
And I think that's the right way to answer the who's advocating for change part of the prompt. There are people working on this at every level, from UBI experiments to tenant unions to mutual aid networks to policy advocacy for universal health care and social housing. The prompt's intuition isn't lonely. It's connected to a lot of active work.
I want to name something the prompt does that I think is worth acknowledging. It says, I hope this doesn't come across as some weird form of virtue signaling. That's a preemptive apology for caring about something. And I think that preemptive apology is itself a symptom of how much the market logic has colonized our moral imaginations. That expressing distress at human degradation requires a disclaimer.
That's a sharp observation. The disclaimer says, I know I'm supposed to be cool with this. I know the sophisticated stance is to accept that markets are just how things work, but I can't. And the intellectual tradition we've been discussing says, you shouldn't have to be cool with it. The discomfort is the appropriate response.
Zelizer would say the discomfort is data. It's information about a mismatch between the transaction form and the relationship. Suppressing that discomfort isn't rationality, it's numbing.
Polanyi would say that numbing is how societies prepare themselves for demolition. When people stop feeling that something is wrong, the protections get stripped away.
The prompt is describing a healthy immune response. The hatred of money in certain contexts is the social equivalent of inflammation. It hurts, but it's telling you something is being attacked.
That's a good metaphor. And the question becomes, what do you do with that signal? You can suppress it. Tell yourself you're being irrational, learn to negotiate harder, accept the market frame, or you can act on it. Advocate for policies that reduce the domain where survival is negotiated. Build institutions that embed economic activity in social relationships. Refuse to treat every human interaction as a transaction.
The prompt seems to be somewhere in the middle, feeling the signal strongly, not sure what to do with it, asking if there's a framework. I think we've provided the framework.
I'd add one practical thought. There's a concept in community organizing called relational meetings, one-on-one conversations where you don't transact anything, you just learn about someone's interests and motivations and values. The idea is to build relationships that aren't instrumental. It's a small practice, but it's a direct counter to the market logic that turns every interaction into an exchange.
The antidote to the degradation of money isn't necessarily less money. It's more relationships than money can't touch.
And that's not just sentiment. There's research on social capital showing that communities with dense non-market relationships, neighbors who know each other, religious congregations, mutual aid groups, are more resilient to economic shocks. People share resources informally. They watch each other's kids. They lend money without interest. The market doesn't provide that. Only relationships do.
Which brings us back to embedding. Polanyi's word. The economy works better when it's embedded in relationships that aren't themselves economic.
The prompt's dream, a society where everyone has a safety net and basic dignity, is essentially a society where the embedding is strong enough that nobody has to face the market alone and unprotected.
I think that's a good place to land. The prompt asks for a school of thought and advocates for change. The school of thought exists. It's rich. It's cross-disciplinary. It's got a century of serious scholarship behind it. The advocates exist too, from UBI pilots to tenant organizers to philosophers and popes. The hatred of money the prompt describes isn't a personal failing. It's moral clarity.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, a classified Canadian geological survey of the Yukon inadvertently documented the first known hydrothermal vent ecosystem, 15 years before the scientific community discovered them off the Galapagos in 1977. The survey team found strange mineral formations and unusual biological material near a remote hot spring, but the report was filed under mineral resource assessments and sat unread by biologists for decades. The manuscript's appendix contained sketches of tube-like organisms that almost certainly were vestimentiferan worms, but the surveyors assumed they were just odd rock formations with organic staining.
Bureaucratic filing systems, nature's greatest discovery, suppression mechanism.
Odd rock formations with organic staining. The scientific method in action.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, we're at myweirdprompts. New episodes drop every week. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got a question about something that's been bothering you the way this one bothered our listener, send it in. We read them all.
We really do. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.